Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You'll find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are also available. I'm Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor at the New York Times, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our guest, Becky Worley. Becky has been covering technology as a TV reporter since 1998. She's worked at what she calls the truly geeky ends of the spectrum, we'll see about that, at Tech TV and This Week's Week in Tech, as well as the most mainstream and mass market outlets you can find. This includes her current positions as technology contributor for Good Morning America and host of Upgrade Your Life at Yahoo News. Becky started her TV career fresh out of college, working in news for Seattle's KOMO-TV. In 1998, the creation of an all-technology network called ZDTV was a dream come true, TV and tech. During her 6 years at ZDTV, Worley produced three different shows and hosted a live, hour-long computer help call-in show. When Tech TV created an eight-hour technology news format, Worley was tapped as an anchor. From there, she started making guest appearances as a tech expert on Good Morning America and was eventually hired as the network's technology contributor. She has appeared on World News with Diane Sawyer, Nightline, and 2020, and has hosted shows for the Travel Channel, the National Geographic Channel, and the Fine Living Network. Becky's expertise lies at the intersection of consumer reporting and technology reporting, and her stories feature budget-friendly, easy-to-use, life-enhancing gear. Her hope is to highlight the fun and convenience the technology can bring, but she also offers some much-needed advice on how to alleviate the annoyances caused by our fully wired world. As such, she is the author of Security Alert, Stories of Real People Protecting Themselves from Viruses, Identity Theft, and Scams. Worley attended Middlebury College in Vermont and has a master's degree from Stanford University. She graduated through a program called Learning, Design, and Technology that focuses on technology and education. Please join me in welcoming Becky Worley to the Commonwealth Club. Okay, so what I'd like to resolve tonight, if we can, is why do we have such a difficult relationship with technology, and how can we make that better? And
how much time do we have?
Well, an hour, but, you know, if we get any left over, we can talk about apps that we love.
Well, that's the answer.
There you go, apps we love. But
okay,
I wanted to start by saying something Douglas Adams said, I believe, which was that any technology that is there when we're born is just part of the world. We take it for granted. And any technology that arises when we're 20 is a fantastic innovation that should have been here ages ago. And you can see where this is going. Any technology that comes along when we're 40 is a horrible, world-destroying force that must be stopped at all costs. And I think that, you know, besides just being hysterical, the point he's making is we have always lived with technology. We are beings that make tools, and we have, you know, bent the world to serve our needs since forever. It's what we do. It's one of the things that defines us human. But at the same time, change is hard to accept, and technology can present great change.
But I think that the seminal point here is that the pace of technological change in our lifetimes has been outrageous.
Sure.
And so it has given rise to people who have jobs like mine who help people deal with those problems and with the pace of that change.
You know, people tell me that, but in the 19th century, nighttime turned into day for the first time for people, okay? My grandmother was born in a sod hut in Kansas and lived to see a moonshot. You know, tech has been advancing for a while. Maybe the difference is now it's up close and personal and we have to engage with it, which is a source of it's like the Becky Worley Full Employment Act, right?
Great job security.
There's so much anxiety from people encountering technology.
Well, when I started really working in tech journalism, there were lots of people who were covering the moonshots, who were covering the rise of these amazing gadgets, software companies, the rise of the personal computer. But there weren't that many people who were willing to talk to folks about exactly that point, about how to make those things work for you.
Right.
And there's always been a factor of intimidation around technology and the idea that, oh, this is for, there's something about it that I think is part marketing and part that it came from NASA.
I was just going to say, the industry itself likes to sell difficulty. That justifies high prices.
Oh, well, definitely. It's why, you know, the software box, you could have a tiny little CD, but no, let's make it a big box with a big manual in it. And not only does that make it seem like it's an incredibly valuable product, but it actually gives you the perception that you're buying something more.
And like all great marketing, there is a basis in truth. I personally cannot put 1 million transistors on a chip. Hats off to the guys who can.
But I think
at the same time, you know, there's been a kind of built-in bias in the Valley. And let's go ahead and indict them. You know, when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, he did this weird, quirky, revolutionary thing. He made a computer that came out in 6 different colors. And people thought, man, that guy is edgy. Well, no, he wasn't really. You know, because, like, that, at the time, computers cost getting on to $2,000.
It was,
for any family, it was the most expensive purchase after a car and a house and had no resale value. And yet it came in beige and black and had a 1-inch thick manual you were supposed to read. Mm-hmm. And Jobs' great insight was, why don't I make it, you know, sort of like a toaster or a blender or anything else in your life? You know, you turn it on and it starts working. Wow, how visionary.
Right. But that was the start of the demise of the PC. It was both the rise and the fall. I mean, I think when you really imagine what's happened, and you know, I think of the first PC that I owned, and it was, I found the invoice the other day. It was that $2,500 Apple computer.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wow, this is huge. This is as big as a car. And that was the start. And yet at the same time, now 25 years later, really computers have been commoditized. And if we look at the idea that Dell, Microsoft, they're flailing.
Yeah.
We really can see that there's that transitional point where computers were hard, they made us think that they were hard, and now they're sort of turning the curve where we do expect them to be appliances.
What Apple has done and what very, very powerful chips and software have been able to do is let these industries have a much better design principle, so that they're more consumer-friendly. There's a long way to go.
Right.
But they really are easier to use than they used to be, don't you think?
Well, I think 100%. I mean, when I look back at those days in 98, 99, 2000 of doing call-in shows where people were trying to do simple, basic things, and fundamentally I'm standing there on live television thinking, oh, my Lord, how am I going to explain how to do a registry hack before the next commercial? That was not a good, you know, that's
I'm
not
glad
a good
they didn't
user-friendly.
Ask me.
Yeah, it's gotten easier, but, you know, I think fundamentally we just keep introducing new things.
And it's gotten easier. Are your viewers notably happier?
I think that technology has become more user-friendly, and I think that people are starting to see it more as an appliance, and we have a high expectation of ease of use, and the tolerance level is for difficulty is going down. And I think that you can look at Apple's market share as a clear indicator of that fact. I think that you can look at the demise of software to that point. Is no one's going to take the time, really, unless you want to be an expert, to learn every tweak in Photoshop or every keyboard shortcut in Final Cut Pro.
Yeah, I see what you mean by the demise of software. On the other hand, software is just taking over everything.
Well, and I think that, you know, as people think about their apps, apps are just software on a mobile platform, and now instead of having one big $75 or $150 purchase, you have 99 cent subparticles of what used to be bigger software suites. Mm-hmm. And now that's all that an app is. It's just a different kind of tool.
What do you think has come along that really works well? What do you love personally?
I really believe in accessible everywhere information. I mean, the idea that Evernote holds my life. I think that the idea that Mint helps me feel more organized and ties in with a bill-paying service.
If these
are
mysteries to you, Evernote is a pretty easily discoverable website into which you can store photos and documents and
make lists,
take pictures of food and put it up there and sort of basically memorialize your whole life.
Right, and it's a way to stay organized. I became a computer geek because I couldn't stand the sight of my own handwriting, and I'm terrible at keeping paper organized.
Okay.
And so when I saw a file directory, I realized, oh, this makes sense, and I'm not going to have little pieces of white paper sticking out. I can actually create my own organizational structure for my thoughts and not have to look at my own messy handwriting, and I can be organized in a computer in a way that I can't be in the real world.
And if it sounds hard to, you know, have to catalog all your photos and documents or whatever, Evernote's a pretty good example of good design making life a little bit easier.
And that's where I think actually when what works best about something like an Evernote is that it's accessible on a computer where input-output is most, sort of facile to typing. And then it's also accessible on your phone where you need that information on the go.
Mm-hmm.
I see all of the elements of computing. I don't think the laptop is ever going to go away. A lot of people do. I don't think so. I don't think that a mobile device will ultimately be the one device that rules them all. I think that the company that wins input-output, typing, voice recognition, eye gesture recognition, that might be the company that wins mobile. But fundamentally, we have a speed advantage and we're all acclimated to typing.
You know, my job is to abstract things a little bit, and I think these kind of divisions about laptop, tablet, and mobile are really very rearward-looking, and they speak to sort of older industries. It's strange to even call an iPhone a phone. You know, yeah, you make some voice calls on it, but
if you you're
might
lucky.
Call it, some days it's the iCamera and the iGaming board and the iCalendar. Like, it has so many other functions that phone is just one of many. And, you know, likewise, tablet, laptop, they describe instances of where we're really heading, which is a kind of continual presence of information everywhere that you'll be able to access and communicate with all this data and all these people at all times. And for our kids, that's going to seem like a birthright.
Do you think that I was trying to fix a bike last night, and I was thinking to myself, okay, I've got to get the iPad out here so I can figure out how to get these brakes unscrewed and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, man, you know, even just 10 years ago, you'd either have to take this bike in or you'd have to accumulate the knowledge yourself and become an expert in something to this or have more niche specialty plays that were your area of expertise.
Yes.
And I just wonder.
And instead of falling to your knees in mute wonder, you thought, gosh darn it, now I have to go get my iPad. Right?
I did, but then
it's never enough with us, right?
I did, and I was thankful for that, trust me.
Yeah.
But I wondered if our kids will end up being so reliant upon general knowledge that they fail to accumulate specialty knowledge and that there'll be a void in the future.
Well, that's actually something I want to touch on later in our talk, which is the things technology makes us fear, and chief among them is have our children become a different species. Let's touch on that in a minute. But you mentioned Mint, which is a personal finance site.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you love?
I'm really interested in a category I'll call appcessories. So it's the idea of physical devices that tie in with your smartphone and are controlled by the smartphone. So the really clear example of this is the Nest thermostat.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a thermostat that was designed by one of the original designers of the iPod, and it ties into your Wi-Fi at home. and you download the app onto your phone, and whether it's that you're too lazy to get off the couch and go to the thermostat and turn the heat down, and then you can use your phone to do that job, or you're away and you want to make sure that you turn the heat down, you can check and see what the heat is in the house right now, and if you, oh, I forgot to turn it down, you can do that right on your phone. It keeps stats on what kind of energy usage you have. Right. And it's this idea of, you know, the Internet of Things. But
it sounds kind of pathetic when you say this is the most interesting thermostat you'll ever own. But it's true in this case. It is amazing what this thing can do.
Yeah, and I mean, another example would be the Sonos, which is a device that broadcasts music through your home that's controlled off of your iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in low-power Bluetooth devices, which allow you to put a battery into, let's say, a key fob, and that battery will last a year. And it's tied to an app on your phone so that when you're within range of it, which is, what, 50, 45 feet for Bluetooth, it will direct you or it will force that key fob to make a sound so that you never lose your keys again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I like this idea of apps and things that go together, real things.
I'm going to just take a second to bring in a couple questions from the audience, and these were very pragmatic. Do you know what the best software package for generating, protecting, and providing passwords might be? Is there such a thing?
Well, there are certainly password wallets, and there are many that are good. I don't have a specific brand in mind, but one thing I can tell you about passwords is the best way to get a good password, and this is from Steve Gibson, who's one of my favorite security guys. He has this concept called password padding.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you use just numbers in your password, every character has 10 variables, 1 through 10. Then if you use, or 0 through 9, I guess, if you use alphabetical characters, you have 1 through 26. So that's sort of another set of variables. But if you use symbols on your keyboard, it's hundreds of variables. So his point is, you might have your standard alphanumeric password right now, but pad it with symbols. So
right.
You might have...
Choose a symbol you put in the middle of the string.
Or put at the end of it, put hashtag, hashtag, exclamation, at.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done all kinds of cracking experiments, and those are the toughest to hack and to crack. So,
and the easiest to remember.
And the easiest to remember, because they don't have to be 12 different characters at the end. They're enough in the keyboard that you could just pick two and
mm-hmm.
just repeat them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's little tricks like that that are smart people who are doing incredible research, and my job is to translate that into something that we all can use. So go change your passwords right now.
Okay. But first, answer this question. Well, it's a two-parter, really. Both on Windows 8.
Oh, great.
First
this is
one.
Be fun.
Well, we're going to get your love-hate right away, because the first part of it is, why should I upgrade from Windows 7? What is it speedier? Is it more solid? What are its features that make it something you'd want to own?
Okay.
Go there.
Windows 8 has one truly compelling feature for the consumer, and that is it is the first operating system, full operating system, that really works with touch. And so despite Steve Jobs' protestations that you don't ever want to be typing and touch at the same time, all of us who have tried an iPad with a keyboard and thought, thank you, Lord, would completely disagree with him.
Mm-hmm.
So what Microsoft has done right is they've enabled this operating system to work with touchscreens. And many of the great laptops that we saw at CES this year, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas that just finished in January, which is sort of my prom. It's like my mecca. That was one of the coolest things we saw, were hybrid laptop devices that are touch-enabled so that you can be typing and yet you can use gestures to really control the operating system in a way that speeds up your use. There are many of these Windows 8 machines, and many of the first ones that came out do not have touch screens. They have traditional laptop screens that are not touch-enabled, and you're really stuck with the touchpad or the mouse. In those instances, I find Windows 8 to be as maddening as sleeping on a bed of nails or coating yourself in honey and inviting right. ants over. It's really painful. It's really not a good experience. And I would say that Microsoft has clearly opened the door for Apple to take a lot more market share. I think that the Mac operating system is much more user-friendly. And if you're going to have to learn how to use Windows 8 and the Metro UI, the tile interface, which is very different, there's no start button, people. They've taken away, I know we don't all love it, but the start button is gone.
We knew it.
I know we at least got to know it. Mm-hmm. And to your point about change being hard, I think Microsoft kind of, they underestimated that that change was particularly difficult.
That takes us to the second part of this question. If you do own a Windows 8 machine and you're having a difficult time learning it, what's an easy way to learn it? Are there good manuals? Are there good online tutorials? Have you found anything that you like?
I actually always love the dummies guides. Despite the fact that they're sort of insulting and they follow through on this point that you have to, you know, technology tries to intimidate us, I find them to be very just straightforward.
Right.
I also think that there is a mentality, and this is said with true empathy and love, Mom. You don't have to read the manual. You're not going to break it. The difference between digital natives and those who struggle more with technology is a fear threshold.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the best thing to do is to experiment and find a geeky kid you can pay $10 an hour to come help you.
Well, and bear in mind, like, the geeky kid learned it by making a lot of mistakes.
Exactly,
you know,
right.
You bought it, you get to make mistakes with it too.
Yeah.
You don't have to start out a genius.
I think that I tend to kind of make technology and some of these things, I don't know if the right word is femmy, but I do kind of try and make them. My Yahoo job, my boss cast me, she said, I want you to take on the role of being the Martha Stewart of technology. Now, I have managed to stay out of prison, and I'm a little younger
except
than
except for the insider trading,
yeah.
Which was too bad. Really,
yes, unfortunate.
It sounded like a good job.
I know, especially in tech. I should be capitalizing on this. But I do think that there is a point about demystifying this, and so this analogy comes from that, which is there are two ways to learn to cook. You can either read the recipe and follow it exactly and take that cup of flour and take the knife and take every
right.
last grain off so it's perfectly a cup. Or you read the recipe and you go a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Oh, I don't like capers that much, so actually I'm going to do it this way.
Right.
And I think that computing is best learned in the latter fashion.
Yeah.
It takes a stout heart, and you do have to have a geeky friend, because if you get stuck, you do not want to be calling tech support.
Yeah.
But that's how I learned. I called tech support for hours when I first started really dabbling with computers,
yeah.
and I made many friends. None of them I ever got to see face-to-face.
Devices, what do you own now?
I was using the Samsung Galaxy S2 just because I felt that I needed to become an Android native after many years with the iPhone.
Was that a big transition from an Apple product?
It was. I found that it's not that the architecture of the operating system is so different. Conceptually, it's the same, but this goes back to this, you know, this very basic thing about human-computer interfaces is sometimes it's just about the buttons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get used to certain things that you become very ingrained to you, and
yes.
suddenly when they change, it's like it's disorienting, and you keep making the same mistake over and over because it's muscle memory and it's rote.
Mm-hmm.
So it was little things in the Android operating system. If I just transitioned from a flip phone, I don't think I would have found it as difficult.
It's now outselling the iPad broadly.
Well, so. And for a very obvious reason, which is I think that, you know, the iPhone was so expensive for so long, and Android phones have much more leeway in price.
Yeah.
I do think that, you know, we're at 50% saturation here in the U.S. for smartphones right now. They're give or take.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that until the data plans become more affordable, we're going to be stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, the people who've had the opportunity to upgrade basically based on their contract cycles have done so. And the reason why the other folks haven't is because That data plan is ridiculously expensive, and you cannot get one of these phones without it.
That's going to change in the next year or two.
I think you're right. And I mean, we see the Metro PCSs and the Boosts and all of the really the Ting, all of these interesting services.
The prices come down, and earlier this week I was over at the Mozilla Foundation, the guys who make the Firefox. And a year ago they said they would have an operating system for a smartphone. I have no reason to doubt they're off schedule. And that will be for people in Brazil, people in China, people in Africa, and eventually for people in this country who buy their phone prepaid, which is still a huge, huge number of people. Everybody's going to be carrying one of these things within 3 or 4 years.
I think that's right. And I think the carriers have every reason to be shaking in their boots because I don't think they understand the consumer pressure that they're facing, that the gadget lust alone will not carry them through to 100% penetration on smartphones.
No. It's a pretty expensive thing for a lot of guys living close to the edge.
Yeah.
But eventually you want them as customers too.
Right.
So that will get...
They'll charge the premium up top and then they'll eventually...
What do you think? What has been traditionally quite hyped in your view? What continues to be hyped?
Well, I think there was a big transition between standard definition televisions and high definition televisions. That was a big deal. And the first, I don't know what year it was, I feel like it was during that transition time from the Comdex shows to the CES shows where we first saw the HD TVs come out. And I just remember standing on the floor of the Las Vegas Convention Center with my jaw right around my knees. That transition was huge. And ever since then, the television industry has really been pushing for something of similar
Another
purport.
Upgrade, right?
Yeah. It's going to be smart TVs. It's going to be 3D TV. Now they're pushing two technologies, which is OLEDs and 4K TVs. I don't see them getting ever the same speed of adoption.
What do those big words mean? OLED and 4K TV.
Organic light emitting diode.
I knew that.
And then 4K TV has four times the resolution of our existing HD TVs.
Okay. And I want this because?
Well, independently, they're both nice and good looking, but not necessarily anything that's going to make you want to go out and spend a lot of money.
How many money?
TVs, well, big money right now. We're talking 20K. Starting point.
You got to really like TV to spend
$20,000. $20,000 for a 55-inch 4K TV is spendy. But the point there is 55-inch.
Yeah.
This technology is really made for TVs over 60, 70 inches. And we're seeing those in, you know, more commercial environments. And I think I know maybe one person who has a TV that big. But that's crazy. And that's, I mean, it goes back to
some movie theaters. The screen's not that big.
I know. I know. So I think that the television industry, we will see the prices come down. We will see the combination of 4K and OLED TVs because it's just the way that the industry is going. It's progress.
And like all tech, we'll eventually wonder how we ever could have lived without it.
Without it. But am I advising you to go out and buy one right now? Not unless you won the lottery and you want me to get one too, because I mean I'm willing to learn while you learn and
Where
help you.
Where do you get your tech news? What are some interesting sources away from the mainstream media?
Well, it depends on how you like to get your tech news. So I definitely read the blogs, Gizmodo, Engadget, The Verge, CNET. I love reading the New York Times. I think Pogue is a genius. I think he understands the consumer very well. I really love listening to podcasts. If there's one app that I think this crowd should get on their smartphone, it's the Stitcher app.
Stitcher.
And Stitcher basically allows you to, it's like a TiVo for radio and podcasts. So all of the NPR programs are archived there and you can go listen back to back to back to the last 7 Fresh Air episodes, or you can listen to This Week in Tech, which is probably my favorite podcast to listen to, or you know, This American Life. There's all those things, and it's on demand. So I really love to listen to tech news because it's the insight of the people, and it's if for a certain crowd of people they love to watch, you know, at ESPN, all of the shows where the guys are talking about the inside baseball stuff, if you like that kind of energy, there's a community around tech that is equally passionate, and it's so fun to see them get so fired up over stuff that's so ridiculous.
Let's spend a few minutes on tech and work, because we've seen a phenomenon in the past 5 years in particular called the consumerization of IT. And what that means is people bring in their own phones and tablets and software into the workplace, and work becoming a lot more like home, and as a consequence, home becoming a lot more like work. You know, one consequence of that, and let's talk about work-life balance, is we're always working, right? You know, I mean, the kid may call you up at work too, or the school can call you up at work, but you're sure doing email at home. How do you strike the correct work-life balance?
Man, that is not a topic I should be speaking about at all. One of my best friends from college is sitting in the audience here, and we have been trying to get a date together to go have dinner for the last 3 months.
All right.
It is obscene. Emily, thank you so much for making this work tonight.
Right. Did you bring dinner, Emily?
Yes, please. You know, I understand. I have empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I think barriers and boundaries are crucial. I think that, you know, I haven't worked in an office since 2004.
Right.
I have 5-year-old twins.
Mm-hmm.
I get up at 3 a.m. often to do Skype live shots with Good Morning America in New York from my kitchen.
How character building.
Yes. I have an interesting perception of the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Whether it's my kids crying or George Stephanopoulos calling. I don't know which one it is. But I think that is a serious issue. And as far as advice, this is me speaking to me. When I'm playing, just go play. You know, stop. Just stop looking at your phone. I mean, I do believe, and I have a pretty good sense of actually when I'm with people, I'm 100% with them, and I put the phone away, and I just, there's nothing really that's that important. And I've made decisions in my life and career. You know, I this is going to sound funny, but it's just so ridiculous that I have to tell this. I hope it doesn't sound too egotistical. But at one point, CNN called me and said, we really want you to come be our technology journalist. And I said, well, I'd love to do that. And I, you know, San Francisco is a great place to do it. And they said, no, no, no. You have to come to New York. You have to come to New York because we're going to give you the Dr. Sanjay Gupta treatment. I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, you know, we brought him into New York, and once we got him here, we could really make him into a media personality and send him out to all the other shows. And we think that you would really do well being sort of an envoy between CNN and representing technology for CNN, but you have to be in New York. And I just thought, I think if I did that, my balance would get completely off because you know, you kind of become where you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's why you choose to live where you choose to live, whether it's, you know, you choose to live in Brooklyn as opposed to Greenwich, you know, or you choose to live in Oakland as opposed to Marin. And I just wasn't down for taking on the work value as my God. And I think that I have to remind myself of that a lot.
It's interesting you mentioned Skype, and Skype has completely remade your job. It's remaking a lot of them. It's not just for TV personalities. I was earlier today talking to the head of Cisco, John Chambers, and he said that video will be 85, 90, 95% of all internet traffic.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to keep going. People love this stuff. And with that in mind, somebody from the audience brings up that as a job seeker, I'm finding the new human resource decision makers use Skype and FaceTime to replace in-person interviews.
You
really have to get used to remote communications. Can you let us in on a few secrets the Skype and FaceTime experiences pleasant and effective?
When I'm too overwhelmed to be a technology journalist anymore, I'll just do video coaching. I love it because I would like to say I'm still a jock, but I'm sort of an ex-jock with 6 knee surgeries and aspiring to stay active. But I find that video and television is just like sports. So the same way you stink at playing tennis the first time you pick up a racket, you're going to stink at video conferencing the first time you try it. You're never going to look in the right place. You're going to get self-conscious. You're going to have a light behind your head and look like you're in the witness protection program. It's going to be a disaster. So the first thing I would say is, as you try video and video conferencing, be kind to yourself. Be generous.
Just like Windows 8. It's okay to make mistakes. That means you're learning.
That's right.
When you notice it's a mistake, it means you learn something.
Right.
Yeah.
100%. And just like with all technology, also, stop being so self-conscious. You're just a part of the process. It's not all about you. You may feel weird seeing yourself on camera for the first time. I mean, when I started, what I did is I got a camera from the TV station where I was a producer. I started on the assignment desk answering the phones, and then I went and became a producer, and then I snuck out a camera, and I found a closet, literally a janitor's closet, closed the door, and practiced talking to the camera, and then I would go watch it back. Because at that point in time, I was so self-conscious, even listening to my own voice on the answering machine, I thought, I can never be on TV. And then I just got more and more used to myself. I noticed my tics, and I either fixed it or I just made peace with them. Yeah. And that would be my number one thing, would be practice like you're an athlete, be kind to yourself, and don't look at yourself when you're doing it. Look at the little tiny pinhole camera, because it'll make the folks you're video conferencing with think that you're looking straight into your eyes.
To the extent you can, I did a lot of TV too, try to think of the camera as another person.
Exactly.
That really is who you're talking to. It's a device to get there.
Yeah.
That's a skill. What other technologies do you see coming down the pike that you think will be important to master in the workplace?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think this is sort of an obvious, so I don't know, maybe I'll stall while we think of something else.
Oh, I have a couple.
I would say that mastering social media is critical.
Yes.
And not just being proficient as a lurker, but being a contributor. I think that you have to learn to put yourself out there, and in the right ways.
Yeah. Pointed things other people find effective.
Right. I always advise, start as a utility player. I always think of myself as someone who's in the trades, that I'm someone who's just trying to provide a helpful hint once in a while that might save you time. And if you come across something like that in your own life, then share that with others. It's sort of the Kaizen philosophy of Toyota. If you find one thing every day that makes your life better or easier, that's a great thing to share. That's just sort of some of the ideas. What do you think?
I'd like to remind our listeners that you're listening to a presentation of the Commonwealth Club, speaking with my guest, Becky Worley, about technology and everyday life, the future a little bit, I'm sure. Well, one thing that's manifestly true, I think, is that in the workplace of the future, and this was always kind of true, you don't know everything. And you are not going to be 100% on top of your job, and that's going to be okay. But there's an incredibly valuable skill in, as you say, using social media to point at things that you've found effective and other people find effective. And likewise, there's an incredible job skill called knowing how to ask for help. You know, you're never going to have everything wired, but it's really good to have a network of people who can help you with something, who can connect with something. Knowing how to assemble teams, you know, even if you think you're a lone wolf, you know you're not. There really are no hermits out there. And knowing how to assemble teams, how to collaborate, how to find talent inside and outside your company, an incredibly valuable skill, you know. And knowing how to do that on the fly for different contexts, knowing how to say in the right possible way, well, I don't know very much about that. What can you tell me? And here's what I've learned. Here's something I think I found that you might find interesting. That's going to be a really valuable workplace skill because nobody's got this wired.
Right.
And I think that's just true kind of forever.
Mm. Yeah. I just find that trying to find information, you know, this is another thing that kind of dovetails from what you're saying, which is I don't know the answer. I need to look for the answer. I need to know how to vet what I'm finding as possible answers.
Right.
You know, the old journalism work that we've had to try and figure out how to do in the new world.
And I'm not talking about being helpless here. I'm talking about, you know, being goal-oriented.
Right.
Let's solve this problem together. I think a lot of people can identify with that.
Yeah.
So another question from the audience. How well does remote programming for home security work?
Oh, this is such a good question because I live in Oakland. So.
Why would you worry about home security?
There's really interesting technologies that are coming to light. If you are a Comcast subscriber, you can get their home security built, you know, just added right onto your package, where they'll give you some cameras and some intrusion detection, and you'll be able to monitor this on your cell phone. There are standalone products that can do this. You can use Dropcam, which is just a camera that you would install outside your door, and you can monitor it, and it'll alert your phone when there's activity or motion detected. Of course, you know, you compare that to your more traditional ways of managing security, which is your ADT, your Bay Alarm, whatever. And it's really much more cost-effective to do these ad hoc programs that are more technology-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I just interviewed the head of Reed Brothers, who's a security company in Oakland, about what's working and what's not. And he said in Oakland, and this is, I'm quoting, so I hope I'm not maligning the OPD, which is under fire as it is. But he's basically said that you have to have a confirmed sighting of a burglar in order to dispatch a car to your house. So if you just have an alarm going off, nothing's going to happen. But if you say, I just saw a guy break into my house on my smartphone, they're going to send a car.
Right.
So
what you're saying is have something with a camera attachment so you can provide people with real information.
Right. Cameras help. I know that across the country, one of the big things it's a really big new trend in break-ins and security is door kick-ins.
Yeah.
And so they'll just kick the door in, then they'll close the door behind them and go in, take what they can, and then walk out very casually. So actually it's more exterior bell boxes or even having a box on the outside of your house that looks like it's an external alarm if you have a kick-in will actually help. So I do know a lot about this.
Okay.
I'm a strange expert in home security technology all of
Good
a sudden.
Good for you. You got kids. The electronic garbage pile, someone in the audience says, is get out of control. What's the most responsible way to recycle your electronics?
Well, I think that there are many ways to do this. One, you can do it as a charity. Lots of local charities will accept electronics, and they actually make money off of them.
Mm-hmm.
So check with your local charities. That's one way. But I would just strongly recommend reselling or trying to resell your gadgets. There are about four companies that are really good: Gazelle, C-Exchange, Nextworth, and then you can sell your gadgets on eBay, where you'll get the best price, but you'll go through the biggest hassle. And even if your gadgets aren't saleable, whether they're too old or what have you, those companies that I just mentioned will recycle them for you. I think I just read a study that says that 66% of U.S. homes have two or more unused cell phones just sitting in drawers.
All right.
They're only losing money when they're in drawers. So while you can be green, you can also make green. Sell them now. Get rid of them.
If they're being reused, they're being reused.
Right?
That's great. Okay, there is a term of art in the tech world called FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And I want to move to the FUD round because I do these loose polls of what are things the average person is afraid of around tech. And I'll move to one I referred to earlier. Are the kids turning into a different species?
Mm-hmm.
Do you find the younger generation that grows up inside this tech particularly different?
I think that the big question is, it's hard to tell right now because social media is so nascent, and that this round of digital natives that are 18 to 25 right now are the first that were really natives to social media. And they made huge mistakes,
mm-hmm.
big things that will haunt them.
Pictures on Facebook, what
pictures
else?
Pictures on Facebook, I know this is going on radio, so I'm just going to say this as generically as I can. One of my friend's kids posted something on Facebook yesterday about a website that connects. You can list out your Facebook friends you would be willing to be intimate with, and it doesn't tell them about that until they use the same service, and if there's a crossover match, it alerts you to the fact that you would be willing to have casual intimacy with them.
You know,
that worries me. That is just the thing that I just worry.
The astonishing thing to me is they say they're so tech savvy, they don't seem to realize that there are people scraping the internet and storing it and storing all sorts of peculiar information all the time on all sorts of sites that teens go to that I'm not going to mention.
I know.
And you're looking for a job 10 years out, 15 years out.
You got a lot of reputation
cleanup. Nobody's going to say anything, but it's going to come up. You know?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that already.
That probably is the biggest change, I would say, in this generation. We didn't grow up having to worry about our public persona.
Yeah.
You really have to start worrying about it by the age of 15 now,
I think that we need to have a lot of empathy for this crew because, you know, I can remember being at my mom and dad's office when I was about 13 and dropping my pants down and jumping up on the Xerox machine, you know?
Right.
I am just saying, they're doing that on a global internet scale.
Yeah.
And it's like, God forbid that paper got into someone's hands.
Right.
But it's the same thing. It's the novelty of technology married with, you may be tech savvy, but you're not world savvy. And it's just, the stakes are so high. And I actually am so grateful that my kids are little. And that, at least that, I think they'll be able to get a hold of, and I'll be able to parent them through a little bit with a little bit more now than had it they been, you know, if they were 18 or 20 right now.
Okay. Next on the FUD list, how real a threat is cyber terrorism?
Oh, I think this topic is really interesting, and despite the fact that, you know, I'm all over the map with as a technology journalist and as a consumer journalist. This is probably the far reach for me is security, but I'm really fascinated by it. You know, I think that when we look at something like the Stuxnet worm, which is something that was released into nuclear facilities, and they hit these types of systems that were thought to be so secure. And these are the systems that run our power grids.
This was ingenious.
Right.
Let's spend a minute telling the story,
because
it really is ingenious. Probably Israel and the U.S. managed to get inside a centrifuge, this thing that spins at an incredibly high rate, inside a facility in Iran that was not connected to the internet at all.
Right.
And taught it or commanded it not just to spin so fast that it destroyed itself, but to then erase itself so you couldn't find any trace of it.
Right. And many think that this really put the Iranian nuclear program back sometime. It's hard to know how much. And given that this is maybe the first foray that really we know about, it's hard to know how much work has been done in this, although one would think a lot.
And since then, we've seen some bounce back on the Iranian side, probably at us.
Right.
Both sides are doing this at
and
a low
I think
level.
The, you know, the systems that this particular worm attacked are called SCADA systems, and these are the systems that run all of the big infrastructure. And it really was a wake-up call about security that's crucial here in the U.S. And you see, you know, I think that there must be a concerted effort to think about something like this for North Korea. So when you think about this at a cybersecurity issue at this global level, there is some major stuff going on that we don't know anything about right now. I truly believe that. Then you have it at a corporate level where you see all of these threats and attacks on companies. Basically, it's kind of holding a company hostage for its data or using its data in a sort of an espionage, corporate espionage way. That is definitely happening. And there's much talk that it's impossible to fully defend systems at a corporate level and that you can't win on defense.
Yes.
You have to go on offense. But who's going on offense? Can you imagine any corporate lawyer saying, yeah, let's go after those guys in Russia right now? No. So that's the Wild West as well. On a personal level, I think that we've seen it get better. I know everyone, you know, Norton and McAfee don't want you to think that, but I think it's gotten better since the days of the I Love You Worm and Melissa and all of those viruses that would shut down the internet for a few hours. We saw that, you know, it really happened. It did blank people's computers. That was bad. We don't have that to that level right now. And the threat of that kind of mobile intrusion has never materialized. I'm not saying it won't, but it hasn't. And really, the threat around cybersecurity for you as a person is having your phone stolen. So
right.
You need to have a program like Lookout if you have an Android phone, or use Find My iPhone if you have an iPhone, to be able to remotely erase all the data on your phone. This is probably the most important app you need to have.
Right.
Wow, we went from North Korea down to if you leave your phone in a taxi. That was.
I don't know which is more terrifying to people. Another fear point among many people, will I have a job? Is software just going to eat up everything and there won't be any work?
I think that I can only really address this from a personal level.
Yeah.
And just use the story of journalism. You know, when blogs came out, when Craigslist came out, every print journalist was shaken in their boots.
Right.
And there have never, at this point in time, 10 years later, been this many people working in journalism in the history of the craft.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's true for every industry, but I think it is true for many industries. I do think it's a rough time to be in transition in your industry.
Sure.
I do not envy anyone that, and I think that is no joke.
Yeah. There are new job skills, though, and there's new kinds of work popping up, too. One of the questions we had was, what do you think of 3D printing, for example? Machines that can just make any object.
So 3D printing, and I'll kind of back up and do the backstory on this. You've been good at helping me with this so far, Quentin. But 3D printing is the idea that you can put in a program, use a program to design a product or a prototype, and then this printer will print a three-dimensional plastic, basically, version of it. It's fabulous for rapid prototyping in manufacturing. It's fabulous for design guys. Let's say you want to invent the newest toothbrush. This 3D printer is the greatest thing that ever happened to you. And about 12 years ago, I was out here, I was actually in the East Bay, and Sunset Magazine had, maybe it's about 10 years ago, Sunset Magazine had Home of the Future, and it was at a beautiful area. I can't remember where it was, but somewhere around here. I remember because it was warm, and it was the first time. I lived in San Francisco at the time. I was like, whoa, this place out here through the tunnel is nice. So I remember going there, and up in the technology shop, they had like an office space where you would have your home office where you'll be able to do work, you know, and they also had a 3D printer. This was 10 years ago. And they said, what if you break your last Pyrex cup that measures 2 cups and you desperately need it for baking? You can print one right up. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is grab the prototype CAD program off of the internet and print right here. I thought, that is so cool. But would I ever use it? And I was just thinking about this the other day, that 3D printing has been pushed so much as this new panacea for the home, especially in the last year or two, because the price of these printers has come down. And I still say, I ain't buying it. Not for the home. I think it's really cool for thinking about things and in schools and in, you know.
They are now making jet aircraft parts from them.
Love that.
You can make shapes that don't easily lend themselves.
I think it's genius for innovation. I think
right.
It's redonkulous for the home.
Well, yeah. You know, not so long ago in the scheme of things, computers filled whole rooms and cost tens of thousands of dollars. 3D printing might follow the same curve.
Quentin, this program is going to be my downfall. I talk about Xeroxing my backside, and I'm going to be called on for saying 3D printing will never take off.
Well, it may be a while, but
yeah.
Things like that are coming in the margin. It's kind of interesting. We do have anxiety about our jobs and careers and what our kids might study. But there are things I think we can point to with some assurance that will be real job skills in the future. I said being able to connect people, knowing how to ask for things, being aware of new developments and what it might mean in your industry. Likewise, I have insisted both of my sons study statistics. Because there's so much data around, and knowing what the data means, even if you're in the humanities, knowing, you know, whether or not this data was massaged, what it means, how to read it, is going to be a job skill in every field.
So I have a question. In this crowd, we have, what, about 50, 60 people here?
Yeah.
How many of you have heard of the idea of big data? Right. The idea that data, so that's well more than...
For our radio audience,
two-thirds.
It's looking like 70%.
Yeah. So the idea that all of your activity and your web browsing and your any of the metrics that can be kept on you are being kept on you. How many people here does that make you uneasy? Yeah, about a third, including my esteemed interrogator.
Well,
here.
It should, you know.
That why? I disagree. I don't see it as a problem. I worry that an insurance company might think, oh, she's been researching a lot about, you know, some medical concept and think, oh, then maybe I won't offer her insurance. That worries me. But hopefully in the coming years that won't be as much of an issue. Other than that, I just don't see a good case study for why I should be so worried. Convince me.
Well, a couple things. One, as data becomes readily available and information is everywhere, everything can turn into a marketing event, and you will always be sold. Every device you buy will start pushing information at you with upgrades and advertisements, and that's going to be really tedious.
Okay, well, from the perspective of the consumer, that's how we get free information.
Fantastic.
And from the perspective of you and me, thank God, that's where my paycheck comes from.
Maybe so, but it's also a huge time suck. You know, it's really going to reorder your day.
Well, it's cat and mouse because you're learning to ignore all that stuff. Is that a sponsored ad or did someone post that in Facebook?
So you're digging all those billboards on the highways too. Is that what you're telling me?
I see where you're going.
You're saying it's sort of like electrical wires in cities. Basically, they're really ugly. We just stop looking at them. We don't even. If you looked at all the wires above your head all day, you'd be like, where'd the sky go? But we don't even see them, and we see the sky instead.
I think the Country Outfitters boot ad has shown up in my Facebook feed 3 times a day for the last 3 months, and I now don't see it anymore. I'm like, oh, there's the boot ad. I'm either all my friends have turned into cowboys, or else these people are like bombing Facebook,
but
and
more,
I just don't see it anymore.
More go intimately, years ago, a guy at Google said to me, you know, after a while, we don't want their name. The name is noise.
Yeah.
We already know so much of the rest of the behavior.
Yeah.
And that's going to become, as I said, you know, as we get to this information everywhere area, and every device is in two-way communication, people are going to know things about your habits and your proclivities and read you and make conclusions about you in ways you can't even expect yet. And this may be some horrifying truth about how predictable I actually am. I like to think I'm a little serendipitous, and life's going to be bland if I can always be predicted. But more to the point, you know, they're going to organize society around me. And maybe that's what worries me the most. You know, we are right now 30 years into a really great age of marketing and people custom target. The food in this town is different from the food in Oakland, and there are more choices and it's more segmented. And I ultimately worry that we don't encounter difference in the society very much, you know?
You mean like your demo defines you, your demographic defines
you? Your demo defines
you.
You know, you live in a gated community, your kids don't serve in the army. Like, how many times do you encounter somebody who's not like you educationally, intellectually, financially? You know, you encounter people like yourself all the time. Right. And that's bad in a democracy because you live in an echo chamber of the same kind of opinions.
Right.
And I worry about that where big data is concerned.
Yeah.
I think you'll encounter more and more things that reinforce your point of view, and that's not healthy.
I think that's an excellent big picture view. You know, and I think you're right from a societal standpoint.
Yeah.
But
and
from an individual standpoint, it doesn't
bug me. You have to force yourself into serendipity.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of test this against blogs you wouldn't read or places you wouldn't normally walk, things like that. And that's going to become an important part of keeping democracy alive.
I see that societally, and I think that, you know, you see it at a bigger scope. I see things so much as a consumer reporter that I think advertising is a small price to pay for all the information we get for free.
Yeah. Do you ever read those licenses you sign when you get that for free?
I have a I have a no EULA policy because if I tried to understand the Facebook EULA at its deep, deep, deep level, I would cringe, I'm sure, too.
Yeah. Well, they're basically modified corporate software licenses, and they say we can take your firstborn child if we feel like it.
But I also think...
And you clicked yes.
Yeah, but from an invisible hand sort of perspective, it's not good business for them to do so.
No.
And we've seen companies, PATH being a good example, that overstepped the bounds and they lost their reputation. And it's not in Google's interest. It's not in a lot of these companies' interest. I was about to say Facebook, and then I realized they've overstepped their bounds so many times.
Yeah.
And then they've pulled it back. And they are in a constant pendulum swing.
A corrective to what I was saying. Yeah, things can be put in the public eye the way they never were before.
True.
And that's a strength.
Yeah.
You know, the future is scary. There's no question. But at the same time, like, if I could bring anyone from history into this moment and say, you're going to have devices in your pocket that connect you to basically all of the information and the ability to communicate with, in two ways, I don't know, 4 or 5 billion people, and we're ambivalent about whether or not we want this.
Right.
You know, they'd think we were insane.
Mind blown. Just
yeah. You know, who wouldn't want to be alive now where that's concerned? We have a few minutes left. Do we have questions from the audience?
You guys had really good questions.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Yes, sir.
Do you really think there's...
Oh, I'm sorry. Can we bring... I'll just repeat your question. In the age to come, in the internet we're building, is there any privacy whatsoever?
I think there is privacy in that there is such a glut of information that it's very difficult to sift through it to actually find you. If you've tried to find something out about someone, you know, as reporters, we often have to dig and dig and dig, and not always about well-known people who have lots of information already published about them, but about everyday people. We often, especially I feel like I vet people often before I put them on TV because I just want to make sure they are who they say they are. It's harder than you think to find the good stuff. Either it's buried or it's not as accessible to the layman. I personally think that privacy right now is chosen. If you choose to be private, I think you can be mostly private. I know there are exceptions. I know there are ways that this can be circumvented, but who really wants to know that much about you? That's kind of the bottom line is, I guess, my own sense that we are all just on the journey together. It's more of a sociological thing. I'm just not that worried about it. I'm on TV hundreds of times a year. And I think I've been recognized in Oakland twice. And I think that people have sought me out even less. Having worked in the television industry for 20 years, I find I am so out there, nobody cares. I'm just like, I find that to be very reassuring. I know that sounds a little weird in the way I'm saying it, but we're all just doing our thing, and I think we're fine.
Can I put my hand up on that question, too? Because for starts, I think it's important to remember that privacy throughout history has been continuously redefined. You know, what's public and what's private is a real moving target. And in some ways, the absence of privacy has had certain benefits, things that people used to be ashamed of around their religious doubts, around their sexuality, can now be made public. And that's a good thing. You know, in the large, it can be abused. But in general, I think people would agree that's been a good thing. That said, Becky, are you high? There is no privacy left, you know. And the cost of finding things out about people is dropping like a rock.
I know.
Who's interested depends on how much it costs. When it's near free, lots of people.
Right. Okay, so here's the thing. The one thing people really want to know about others is, have you been looking at my Facebook page? And how much time have you spent on my Facebook page? Right. That's what people want to know. And Mark Zuckerberg is smart enough to know that as soon as that information is made public, the service is done.
If you want to see someone move fast, tell them their tweet was favorited. They'll go look it up instantly.
Right.
Who did
that?
You know, that's wonderful.
I just see the dichotomy as hilarious, that we're putting ourselves out there in ways that are bigger and more elaborate than we ever have,
sure,
to self-publish ourselves, to, you know, as Reid Hoffman called it, the startup of you. That's mm-hmm. the title of his book. And we're putting ourselves out there, and then we are worried about privacy. And I don't know. I am a little bit of, you know, I definitely think
that
I'm unrealistic.
Are you suggesting we want it both ways?
There's a possibility that there's a little bit of a...
There you go. I think we can take one more quick question if anybody's got one. Yes, ma'am. Are there buzzwords we hear all the time that we're completely sick of hearing?
Well, 3D printing would have been one, so you got me there.
Well, I was going to go with big data, so...
Yeah, big data is one. You know, it goes back to... I'm going to have to think of what would be... It's the computer world. So I've started at Tech TV in 1998. So in this 15 years, the jargon factor has gone down in an outrageous amount. It's so much better than it used to be. It's not as dramatic.
Yeah.
And there is a space in technology for everybody now. And I think that, you know, my message always has been, be empowered. You are absolutely smart enough and with it enough to do this and do anything you want in technology. And so if there's a buzzword you don't know, and I've been doing this for years saying, what does that mean?
Yeah. We used to worry about phrases like CMOS and OLAP. Now it's monetize, and at least I know that's something about money. So, there you go. Well, that's all the time we have for our thanks very much to Becky Worley, technology contributor for Good Morning America and host of Upgrade Your Life at Yahoo News.
We better get this.
We also thank
our viruses going. I think we've got some sort of an incident
here. Someone saw the hours, like, my phone is back on, you know. That's all you needed to know in technology, and what's coming just happened in the last 10 seconds. I gave you an hour and you got it. Our thanks to Becky Worley, technology contributor for Good Morning America and host of Upgrade Your Life at Yahoo News. We also thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Quentin Hardy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.